So normally today what I would do is go over the control fields and look at the rotating frame transformation. But I'm going to put that off a day because I want to give you the information you need to solve or work on this tutorial problem. And the tutorial problem is a problem that I think is right at the forefront of quantum simulation. So, I always hate, solve this problem that's been solved by every class for the last 50 years. So here you get to solve a problem that hasn't been solved by anyone yet. And you'll be able to solve it. And the community would be interested in your solution. But I need to explain to you about dipolar coupling to do that. So in the second lecture, we jump to about what would be the 12th lecture in an NMR class. But, psi moves faster than other groups, and so it'll all be okay. I want to talk about the dipolar Hamiltonian. And the dipolar Hamiltonian, of course, is the Hamiltonian that measures the energy between two spins. So we have two spins, and they're both spin one-half magnetic particles. And so there's a dipole-dipole energy, and you know this classically. And I'm not going to derive, although it's fun to do, the Hamiltonian from the classical result. We'll just write it down. And if you remember the classical result, there'll be some terms that are reminiscent. So you remember in the classical result that a dipole falls off as 1 over distance cubed, right? And that it has a second Legendre polynomial stuck in the front of it. And the reason that Z is special, of course, is we've said that there's a magnetic field along the Z-axis. So the Z state of the spins determines the energy, right? So that's why it's special. And the Hamiltonian says that we have two spins, and there's some distance between them, and there's an angle. And the angle is relative to the applied magnetic field. All right? Good. Now, if I take this piece of the dipolar Hamiltonian. So the dot product, of course, of two polys is a scalar. So it doesn't transform as I rotate, but it actually controls a lot of the dynamics of the system. So let me write it out. So the dot product has, of course, that simple form, which doesn't look very special. But I'm going to rewrite these two terms in terms of the raising and lowering operators. And you'll remember that the raising and lowering operators look like this. Yeah. So I have two spins in space. So these are, somewhere in space I have two spins. It could be anywhere. And I want the angle between the vector connecting those two to the applied magnetic field. No. There'll be, of course, different energies depending upon whether they're pointed in the same direction or anti-aligned. Just like two bar magnets, right? That if I have two bar magnets and I have them like this. Matters where I put them, what the energy is. And of course, if I flip them, it matters what the energy is. And so, of course, the Hamiltonian is just giving us that magnetic energy. Yeah, they are. Yeah. That's a really, really good approximation, right? I mean, that's we're talking about nuclei and they're separated by bonds. So the dot product is a scalar because if I rotate it by any collective rotation, it doesn't change. Yeah? It is exactly what I wrote, right? Sigma x plus sigma y, sigma y plus sigma z, yeah? And so what I mean by saying it's a scalar is that if I rotate it, it's invariant. So if I rewrite this term in terms of the raising and lowering operators, I see this nice set, and this is shows up in physics a lot, and it's called the flip-flop term. And what does it say? It says that if two spins are anti-aligned, and if they have the same energy, then I can flip them. I haven't changed the energy of the system. Okay. Good. Now, a few properties of the dipolar interaction. The first property is that the average of the dipolar interaction over all space is equal to zero. And you can see that if I take the average of 1 minus 3 cosine squared theta, and I average over theta, that, of course, is equal to zero as well. And you need to remember that this averaging over theta, I'm going to put theta in phi, because I'm actually, of course, averaging over a sphere. And if I just integrated that over a circle, of course, it doesn't average to zero, right? It's because we have this term sine theta d theta in the integrand as we look at this, right? So what does this tell us? This tells us that if I have two spins and the angle between them, keep the vector constant. So let's take I have a water molecule, right? There's two protons in a water molecule, and yet the vector that ties them together is determined by chemical bond. So that's not going to change. And then I allow this water molecule to tumble. Then I will see on average that the dipolar interaction will vanish. And so if I wrote out pictorially the field that one spin would see, well, the field from one spin would be some random function. But the average of that would be zero. And so in liquid state, this term leads to no detectable shifts of the energy, because on average, over any period of time, it's zero. Of course, it does lead to a fluctuating field, which you can see the influence of, but that's not today's lecture. Yeah? Good. All right, so the first is that. And if I look at a spin pair, so if I looked at a spin pair at one orientation, I would see two peaks in the spectrum. So this is a function of frequency, right? So this is just the eigenvalues of that operator at some angle, and this is actually, let's take angle to be zero so that that's biggest, okay? And what does it say? It says, oh, if I have one spin and it was by itself, it would resonate here. But if there's one spin is sitting there and there's another spin up here, and it could either be this way or this way, then it will see a change in the in its magnetic field. And you know, if it's this way, it'll be shifted one way. If it's the opposite way, it'll be shifted the other way. So that's not so interesting. But now let's plot this as a function of theta. And so as a function of theta, this line, so 0, pi over 2, pi, this line, will look like that. This line will look like that. That's a really bad drawing. Pretend they cross in the same place. That's 0, plus 2, minus 2, and these points are plus 1 and minus 1. The first thing to notice is that there's two positions where the dipolar field vanishes. So if I take two spins and I rotate them apply with reference to an applied magnetic field, at one point, that interaction is going to vanish. And this angle shows up a lot of places. It's the so-called magic angle. Shows up, of course, because of the transformation of the second Legendre polynomial. And a nice way to think about this is this magic angle is the bisector of a cube, if I can draw a cube correctly. So that z and that is theta m. And it's 54.7 degrees, but you know, it's a bisector of the cube. And the bisector of a cube is a really nice place, because if I rotate about the bisector of the cube, then I rotate the x-axis into the z-axis into the y-axis into the x-axis. So the rotation about the bisector of a cube tends to make space look uniform. And we said, oh, this interaction vanishes when I average over all spatial possibilities. Rotating about the bisector of the cube, therefore, also causes this interaction to go to zero as long as you're rotating faster than you're looking. So anytime I'm looking, the dynamics have gone through many, many, many of those rotations. So, you know, when I rotate this, so remember that we've got theta and phi, but I'm rotating about this axis when I'm rotating here. So it's not really rotating about phi, right? Because phi is a rotation about z. I'm rotating about z in this transformed frame where I've taken the Hamiltonian and moved it, transformed it into this picture. Yeah? All right. So that's not the purpose of showing this, but it is a nice piece of physics and one that shows up a lot. Now, of course, here we can also plot, let's just do it as an insert, sine theta, like so, just to remind us of how important the various values of theta are, right? I mean, if I have theta equals zero, there's only one way that the two spins can be aligned exactly along that axis, right? If it's rotated away from it, then there's a whole cone of arrangements, right? And that's what this is saying. And so if I sum all of these with the intensity given by sine theta, then I get a new spectrum. That looks like this, which again, the labels are correct, which is a so-called powder pattern which tells me what the location and frequency is for each of these. And of course, you know, you could see what happens. Now, as I change the angle, these two lines come in, they coalesce, they go out, but they don't go out so far, etc. And these things are much more important than those things, and so the central part becomes higher. All right. No, that's what it does look like. Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm missing your point. Here, I've said this is the spectrum you would see if every orientation on a sphere was equally probable, right? So you say I have two spins. I'm going to allow them to be oriented any which way that they like. But I'm going to take and require that they uniformly cover a sphere, right? That the vector interconnecting those two spins uniformly covers a sphere. And then I would get this powder pattern. If I said, oh, no, this, you know, it's not uniform, then, you know, I would have many, many more pointing up than I would have on the equator, then these features would be as intense as those, right? So everything would be, you know, it would be distorted. This thing would be big, and it would look like that. But you never see that. Yeah? Right? But, you know, think about this as this is the probability of having the angle theta. Okay. What have I done? Yeah. So what I did was I took the spectrum at a function of every angle, right? So the spectrum here is this one. The spectrum here is just one sharp line. And then I've weighted it by sine theta and integrated over all of those. Right. Yep. Okay. So that was the first piece. Now, the second piece that I need to property of the dipolar interaction is to note these two commutators. Which are easy to compute. So this piece, the flip-flop term, it commutes with the sum of sigma z, but it doesn't commute with the difference in sigma z. And now if we go back to our Hamiltonian said that we had a Zeeman term that we talked about yesterday, plus this dipolar term. And the Zeeman term, let's write that out again, is omega naught 1 sigma z 1 over 2. I don't usually put in the identities, but I'll do it just this one time to remind us that we're actually living in this two-spin space. And remember that omega naught is equal sub I, superscript I. Is equal to the gyromagnetic ratio of the spin times the field. And the gyromagnetic ratio is a constant for a nuclear species. And so what happens is that if I have two protons, then this term in the dipolar Hamiltonian looks pretty much like that, that the frequencies in front of them are equal. But if I have a proton and a carbon, say, C13 has a magnetic moment, then gamma proton over gamma carbon is about 4. And if I place, you know, this is dependent upon magnetic field. So if I choose a 10 Tesla magnetic field, which is a normal field, then the difference in those frequencies is about 300 megahertz. And yet the dipole-dipole interaction between carbon and protons, if they're separated by about 1.5 angstroms, is about 10 kilohertz. So then it really looks like this term, right? Because now the difference in energy is much larger than the dipolar interaction. So when we're here, then what does that say? It says that this term is secular. Which means it contributes to the energy. Right? It'll shift the energy. Yeah? This term, let me say it differently. This term is secular if the energy is defined by this term, right? Then I'm going to say exactly what opposite what I just said. It doesn't shift the energy, right? It leaves the spins alone. So if the two spins have a certain energy, then this state and this state are exactly the same. Down here, where the energies are different, you know, picture this one being smaller. Then when I shift, when I flip them, flop them, I've changed the energy. Yeah? So this term becomes non-secular. And therefore is removed from the Hamiltonian. Becomes a small perturbation. So in the case where we have proton-proton dipolar coupling, then the Hamiltonian is proportional to sigma dot sigma minus 3 sigma z sigma z. But in the case where it's proton and carbon, then the dipolar Hamiltonian is proportional to minus 2 sigma z sigma z. The flip-flop term drops out. So we have two cases to think about. One, where all of the spins cost the same energy to flip, in which case you're free to flip anti-aligned spins. And the other, where the spins cost different energies to flip, in which case you're not free to flip them, even if they're anti-aligned. Okay. Yeah. It commutes and doesn't commute. right? So the main term, the biggest term in our Hamiltonian is this one, right? This costs hundreds of megahertz. This term costs 10 kilohertz. So if this commutes with this interaction, then it's secular. If it doesn't commute, if I'm thinking about commuting with the Hamiltonian, it's enough to just to think about the biggest term in the Hamiltonian. This is always true, right? You just expand out those polys. Those are always true. The Zeeman term, it depends upon whether the Zeeman term looks like the difference or the sum, right? And that's just corresponds to the coefficients in front of those two terms. Yeah? Okay. Now, I go over here. We saw in the neutron case that we could have an echo. And remember that what we did was we said, oh, imagine that we cross these two beams, or that we put in a magnetic field in one arm, then we put in the magnetic field later on that matched those two, and the effect of the magnetic field vanished. We can do the same thing in NMR. And here, I want to picture that we have a Hamiltonian, which is sigma z, sigma z. So our Hamiltonian is equal to sigma z, sigma z. We'll call it 1 and 2. And I want to look at what happens under this evolution, where I give a rotation. Let's call it about the y-axis of just one spin. So here, during this time, we'll have an evolution that looks like e to the I t1 sigma z1 sigma z2. And I should have a factor of 2 there. Doesn't matter too much. So it's going to evolve, right? The system will evolve as the exponential of the Hamiltonian, and it's evolving for this time. Now, in this time here, I'm going to change this pi over pi pulse. We'll take sigma z1, and it'll rotate it to minus sigma z1, right? It's a rotation of 180 degrees about the y-axis. But it'll take sigma z2 to sigma z2. It's only rotating this first spin. So therefore, the sum of those, it will take sigma z1, sigma z2 to the negative of sigma z1, sigma z2. Okay? And so the evolution during this time is e to the minus I t2 sigma z1 sigma z2 divided by 2. And now you can see, of course, the nice thing is, one, those two Hamiltonians commute. Those two operators are about the same axis. And so I can add them. And so I get an effective operator that looks like that. And of course, if I set T1 equal to T2, this operator is the identity. And that was the original echo discovered by Hahn. Actually, I should be a little careful. The original echo discovered by Hahn was with a 90-degree pulse there as well. It's the same physics, just a little bit messier. So here we say, oh yes, I can take evolution under a series of Hamiltonians if I think about them in an interaction frame picture, right? Because now then, instead of thinking about this pulse as changing a state, I haven't talked about a state at all in this problem. I say, well, this pulse changes the Hamiltonian, right? So we're in a Heisenberg picture, we're in an interaction frame picture. Here, I can say, oh yes, I have this Hamiltonian acting during this time, this Hamiltonian acting during this time. I can combine those actions together, and we can talk about the effective propagator. And if I have an effective propagator, I can talk about an effective Hamiltonian. And of course, if the propagator is one, then the effective Hamiltonian is equal to zero. And so now then, with the power of one simple pulse, we've removed this Hamiltonian from our problem. Of course, we've removed it at that one particular time point, right? It says, yes, if you only look here under the condition that T1 is equal to T2, then it will appear at that instant in time that this Hamiltonian has vanished. And just like with the neutron case, what allowed us to do this was that the Hamiltonian was the same during those two windows. It would have maybe been a little bit nicer if I put a frequency in there, right? In your notes, you might add a frequency. Doesn't matter what it is, just so that t times the frequency gives you an angle. Yeah, but it doesn't matter. What matters is this frequency didn't change. It was the same in both. Yeah? Okay. Now, over here, with the dipolar coupling, it was assumed for a long time that that there was no similar thing. And let me try to explain that, and then I'll show you why this explanation is wrong. So, take a bunch of spins. And just like we did here and here, let's take one of these spins and let's call it a test spin. So we'll say, oh, take this one. And that's our test spin. It's just a thought experiment. And then I can say, well, I have a dipolar interaction between this spin and every other spin in the sample. And so I could ask, well, what does that dipolar interaction look like? And we can add it all up. That's good. But if I take all of these spins to be the same, so let's take everything to be proton, then, of course, these two spins, say, are free to change their state. And when they change their state, the field that this one sees will be different. And then, of course, because these two have changed it, then these two could change, right? Because, you know, this one would now be pointing down. And, of course, you can only flip-flop when things are anti-aligned. And so if I look here, although the system is driven by a perfectly unitary dynamic, it's a multi-body process that connects all of the spins in the system with each other. And so if I look here, I see a fluctuating field. And then the argument is, oh, those methods don't work because the field that this one sees is fluctuating. All right? And then what happened is John Wall, who's a famous physicist at MIT, had a friend building a set of electronics for him so he could do some fancy experiments. And this friend knew nothing about NMR. He knew how to make radios. And so he built the electronics, and he tried it out on some weekend when John wasn't around. And he saw this really long-lived signal. He saw all of a sudden that there was a signal that's lasting forever. And so he leaves that for John. You know, he can't email then, but he can give him a piece of paper. And says, what's this? And John fires back and says, you know, it's garbage in your electronics. Benz don't do that. You know, John's a good physicist. And when he was convinced that the electronics actually was working, then he had to go back and say, well, what's happening with the spins? And so what's happening with the spins I'm going to show you this in a pulse sequence that John Strange developed, not the one that John Wall was looking at, because this experiment is easier to understand than John's experiment. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow the pulses to act on all of the spins. Right? In the upper example, that pi pulse only rotated one spin. But over here, all of the spins are protons, right? They had to be all protons in order for this flip-flop dynamic to work. So over here, we're going to take them to be that. And so the Hamiltonian is sigma dot sigma minus 3 sigma z, you know, plus some coefficients that we don't care about. And so during this time tau, that's exactly what we get, because we haven't moved into any interaction frame. But then I'm going to move into an interaction frame by rotating all of the spins by 90 degrees about the x-axis. And when I do that, well, of course, the dot product isn't going to change. That's still going to appear there. But this piece is going to be rotated along the y-axis. And then here, I'm rotating about the y-axis. And now I'm going to just tell you without proving to you that you have to remember that in the interaction frame, we need to order things differently. Because normally you order by looking at the operator. Now I'm reversing the order so I can look at the Hamiltonian. So if I want to look at this, this gets transformed into that operator. And you can see that by taking this Hamiltonian, and if you want to look at the interaction frame here, you need to first transform by this pulse, and then you need to transform by that pulse. And so ZZ transformed by Y gives you XX, and then XX transformed by X stays XX. And so you get these three terms. Now, this is there for a time tau. We have this evolution for a time tau, this evolution for a time tau. So then the average of this Hamiltonian is going to be sigma dot sigma, which has been there for 3 tau, minus 3 sigma z plus sigma x plus sigma y, each of them for a time tau. And the whole cycle costs a time 3 tau. And then I don't have to convince you that that equals 0. So even though we have this flip-flop dynamics and the spins are free to communicate across a lattice and the Hamiltonian is bloody complicated, we can introduce a modulation sequence that drives the Hamiltonian to 0. And it's very much like the one up here where I said rotate about the bisector of a cube. Right? Take z into x into y. And that's exactly what these pi over 2 pulses are doing. It takes z into x into y. Yeah? Now, there's a big difference between that one and this one. On the top board, the interaction frame Hamiltonian commutes with itself at all time, unless I look carefully at what happens during the pulse itself. Here, these, of course, don't commute with themselves at all time. And so then you're going to be worried that this result is an approximate result that I need to take into account the non-commutivity of those two as I compose the effective. And that's, of course, true. But it's not so hard to deal with because all it says is, hey, make tau small. So if omega for the dipolar frequency times tau is less than 1, then this is a good approximation. Yeah? Yeah. So the average of the dipolar Hamiltonian being 0 means that's right, that the spins have been effectively removed from their interaction. So if I look at this piece here, and I said, take my test spin and measure that field. So the field that my test spin sees, it sees some variation in field because the spins in its environment are fluctuating or exchanging energy, exchanging states. If I look at this same spin as I apply that sequence, and I'm just going to apply that sequence over and over again in time, every time that I have 3 tau, it will look like the spin experienced no field. So it looks like it doesn't see any of its neighbors. Of course, some wild things happen in between, right? But you know, those wild things that happen in between are very well choreographed so that at the end of every 3 tile period, we're exactly back where we are, where we wanted to be. Yes, that's right. Well, it depends on who you are. If you're a chemist, then you're interested in seeing the chemical shifts. You're interested in learning the chemistry of a molecule. And so by removing the dipolar interaction, you've taken a line that is very broad. Let's say, in the case of protons, 60 hertz. And you've shrunk it down to a few hundred hertz, and now you can see things that would otherwise be buried under that line width. If you're a physicist, then you would say, oh, well, this is great. That's what you're supposed to say, this is great. That now, instead of being stuck with this boring Hamiltonian that nature gives me, I can create any Hamiltonian I want. And, okay, the Hamiltonian of 0 is a special case. But you can create any Hamiltonian you want. And that's what you're going to do in the territorial project, is you're going to say, oh, I can take what nature gives me, and then I can find a pulse sequence that will force the spin dynamics of the system to evolve under this Hamiltonian that I'm interested in. You can just, the observable is the sum of sigma x over chemically distinguished spins. So let me save that. I'll talk about that. But we have a coil, we measure a magnetic field. Right? The spins are magnets, they're precessing. So if I have a precessing magnet, then I can easily measure a signal from that. But I want to get to your tutorial project. Good. Okay. So I want to, in your tutorial, to get you to look at creating an effective Hamiltonian that's going to connect to what is current problems in physics. But before then, I want to look at two simple problems. Let's take a spin chain. And there are spin 1/2 molecules, they're spin 1/2s. They're just atoms. And let's say I start with that configuration. And I'm going to apply the Hamiltonian which is the so-called XY Hamiltonian in condensed matter physics. And what's going to happen here? What's the first thing that happens? Yeah? Perfect. Yeah, so here let's not make it periodic. So as exactly as you say that we can flip the first two and go in that direction, right? And of course, we can keep doing this. Now you know that what's going to happen is if I started here, right, then I could flip this way or this way, right? And in fact, the Hamiltonian says you do both. You don't get to choose, right? This is a Hamiltonian dynamic. And so then I can say, okay, let's start here. And then I want to look at going to that state. And so I give you the code for that. It's horribly written, but forgive me for that. And I look at it for different chain lengths. So if I only have two spins, then of course, what happens is I go from one to the other, yeah? And here, I'm just starting with this, taking the sum over those terms, keeping only the nearest neighbor interactions, looking at the evolution. If there's only two spins, then it better go to that. And of course, you can convince yourself that it doesn't go directly between those two, that there's a state in between. And it oscillates back and forth. Nice and boring. But we do get a time. And of course, it oscillates perfectly. It's Hamiltonian, so it better come back. And then if I take three spins, I don't know if you can, well, you can see. This is the starting state, and this is the final state. And now things get a little bit flatter, right? And the time goes out a little bit. I don't know if you noticed, but the original time was 0.125. And I haven't changed the frequencies, and it better go longer, right? Because we're making the chain longer, so it should take longer to get to the end. And we can do it for 4, we can do it for 5, we can do it for 6. For 6, I offset these two. I'm not exactly sure why even, but that's the starting, and that's one plus the other. And you can see, as you expect, that there's a little overlap with the initial state after it evolves away. There's then overlap with the final state. And of course, if I go out far enough, there'll be overlap with the initial state again. Yeah? And if I plot the time that it takes to get to the end of the chain versus the length of the chain here, so this is the length of the chain minus 1 because I was too lazy, then it's linear. And this particular problem, there's nothing quantum mechanical about it. This particular problem is just a fermionic problem of hopping on a lattice. Okay, so you could solve that classically. And the fact that this is linear tells you exactly the same thing. Now, we would like to do something quantum mechanical. So what I want to do, and I describe it as a churn number, and I suggest that you forget that word churn, because that's a whole nother class. It would be a fun class, but we've already tried to shove too much into this class. I have some space over here. Oh, no, I should have one more board here. So the problem I want you to look at is this problem that we talked about the first class of saying that we have three spins. And we're going to look at the, we're going to set up a Hamiltonian such that this spin in the first excitation manifold only evolves in the clockwise direction. Okay, so that if I have one spin up anywhere, it will always go this way. Now, if I wrote down the dipolar Hamiltonian for this system, then, and, you know, let's forget the ZZ piece of the dipolar Hamiltonian, because it's not going to help us that much here. So let's just say that we had a Hamiltonian that was sigma plus, sigma minus, plus sigma minus, sigma plus. And let's label these. Like so. All right, so there's the dipolar Hamiltonian for those three spins. And there should be a frequency in between, in front of them. I'm going to drop the frequency for now. Let's just put that as being approximately like that. Then what does this say? Well, it says that if I had a spin here, then it should go this way. right? Because it's going from up to down. We're looking at this piece. And so it can flip here. And of course, that's this term, right? It says swap those two. Or it could go here. And that is this term. So if I wrote down this Hamiltonian isn't going to give me this directionality that I want. And this problem with that Hamiltonian was solved by Hoffman before you were born. So we want to modify this Hamiltonian. Yeah? Oh, yeah, it is. Thank you. It's that one. Yeah. Okay. Now, it's tempting to say, well, why don't we just throw away that term? And why don't I throw away, throw away the terms I don't want? But you're right, it won't be Hermitian. And then, we're doing something a little bit more brutal than we want to allow ourselves to do. So we actually want a Hamiltonian. And the way we're going to set up the Hamiltonian is we're going to say, oh, well, if this spin was moving in this direction under that term, well, it's a ring, right? And so it could move in this direction with two flip-flops. And I want to arrange that these two terms destructively interfere. And I get it by adding a phase. And I don't have to change plus two to minus. Because things happen twice. So I'll show you, but your insight is spot on. So if we look at yeah. Good. This tutorial is going to work. So if I put a phase here, then I can arrange that interference. The Hamiltonian, of course, is still Hermitian. And if I look at the evolution of the system, so what I've done is this is time, and the three different colors are the three different spin states. And you can see that there's a directionality for this. So it goes from, I don't even know if I can see them up here, but it goes from up, down, down, to down, up, down, to down, down, up. So it goes in a ring. And there's one more thing we want for some nice physics, is this is a single excitation manifold. Of course, there's another single excitation manifold where there's one spin down and two spins up. And if I look at that excitation manifold, then we see that the order is exactly inverted. So now we have a ring system where if one spin is up, it will go clockwise. And if there's one spin down, it'll go counterclockwise. And so now we have these spin polarized edge states. And I want you to, in the tutorial, figure out how to realize this in the lab to say, yes, we can create a situation where if we took this lattice is the boron nitride lattice. So if we took boron nitride and we oriented it in the correct way and we gave the right sequence of pulses, then we would create a spin polarized edge state. Okay? So what I suggest is that today, in the class in the tutorial. Jumping ahead, we'll go right to the lab. That you go through the notebook and have a look and make the modifications you want. And my figures aren't showing up, you bloody. They were in my office beforehand. When you go and you run this on your computer, you'll be able to see that you can calculate the effective band structure for this. Ha! Life is good. And you have, so this is energy versus momentum. The momentum is the velocity of the spin moving around the ring. And as I change the Robbie drive, nothing happens. But really something does. Hey, thank you. We open up some band gaps in this system. And so here, we can start to talk about some interesting physics. Okay? So we'll leave it there, and then we'll continue tomorrow. Thanks.